What do you do between books?
Well, not much time between books. I mean, I've been writing. I got a lot of stuff to write, and I've been doing a little bit of TV and stuff. I did a thing for NBC's American Almanac program. I did an essay on that, and I'm going to do some more of that, I guess.
What kind of work is that? What do you do for them?
Well, they call it an essay. The one I did was about Coca-Cola, about the new Coke and the old Coke, and reminisced about, well, how it used to be to go, when I was a kid, I would go to the store, and there would be this Coca-Cola dispenser. Dispenser was just a big box full of ice, and you'd reach down there and swish around and dig out whatever you wanted. And now, as I said that, they faded from me standing in front of the Mill River store to my son standing in the middle of the Mill River store. So he played me as a boy and stuff. The whole thing just lasted 2.5 minutes, but it took us forever to do it. But it was sort of fun. Yeah.
Roy Blunt, is this book that you're just out with exactly what you had in mind?
No, I wanted it to be a Civil War novel. Nothing's ever quite what I had in mind, but that seems to me that's a good test of reality if it's not quite what you had in mind. And what bothers me are people who seem to think that everything is what they had in mind. The president, for instance. I mean, it bothers me when people are just sort of sure that everything is going the way they want it to go and that everything makes sense the way they think it makes sense, because it seems to me that if you're paying attention, you realize that things are a lot more complicated than that, and they never quite turn out just right. And things did turn out just right, I'd be a little disappointed, frankly.
So your book is filled with the complexities and turnings and twistings of life, so to speak.
Well, I guess so. Complexities and turnings and twistings of semicolons and things like that, anyway. No, things go in a lot of different directions at once, and you need to kind of channel them and focus on them and keep some track of them. But if you try to assume that life goes in a straight line, you're just crazy.
Of course, not exactly what I had in mind as a collection of essays. Some of them are funny, and some of them are relatively serious. You have a profile of Bill Murray, the actor, for example. And you talk about Mark Twain, the funniest American writer. I thought I might ask you, this is something I did before, and it worked out pretty nicely, just to talk to me about a couple of the essays that you have in your book. And I think a good way to start probably would be with the one on who's the funniest American writer.
Right.
And who is the funniest American writer?
Mark Twain. Still is. Was when he was writing and still is. It's an amazing thing. Huckleberry Finn was written 100 years ago, and it's still the funniest American book, I think, and it's really held up. But, as a matter of fact, I think Mark Twain really created the American sound in prose narrative. You know, people write using the vernacular, as a mixture of vernacular and written English in a smooth way, so that it sounds like somebody's talking and it sounds like an American. Nobody but an American could have told that book, and I don't think you can, could have narrated that book. And you can't really say that about books before that. I mean, books, it took a while for American fiction to get the really distinctive American voice that sounds like no other voice now, and I think Mark Twain did it. He never thought of himself as any kind of technical master or anything, and certainly the public thought of him as a humorist. But in fact, he may have been the best American writer at any rate. And he was, he's a little sloppy and tended to do things. Huckleberry Finn's got some, the last part of it's not as good as the early part. People will always argue about it, but you can argue about Hamlet the same way. I mean, it's one of those books that's so perfectly made that everybody knows what's wrong with it. But it's really a funny book. You don't have to stop and think, hey, I bet this was funny in the 19th century. You know, it's just funny. It's fresh and funny and, sounds like somebody talking. And I've always wanted to, I like to write because it's a way to talk better than I can talk. But I want it to sound like speech. That's a kind of Southern thing, to want writing to sound like speech. But I can't even read writing that doesn't sound. I mean, obviously it's.
Well, you used to be a sports writer, and you read the newspaper, and I think among the worst examples of writing can be found in newspapers, even good newspapers like the New York Times, because the style is taught to people in college. It's a very specific style, usually with attribution at the end of a sentence, long, convoluted paragraphs and sentences. And so newspaper writing is not, in my opinion, an example of good writing at all. And as a matter of fact, I think that, I don't know if you should. Did you go to journalism school when you
started? No, I majored in English.
That's good. But because I have a feeling that journalism schools, that's what I studied, I have a feeling that journalism schools don't teach people how to write well. And they teach people how to write form writing. And as a result, I pick up a newspaper and I read it for the information and I just try to overlook the way it's written.
Yeah.
In fact, I think that broadcast writing today is, we don't realize it because it goes away from us so fast, but some of the best writing, if you just did an interview with Charles Kuralt, for example,
mm-hmm.
and he does a series called On the Road for CBS News, and his book is a series, a collection of transcripts, in effect, of these reports. And if you look at them, you'll see they are wonderful examples of writing in the way people talk.
Mm.
Wonderful examples. They can translate easily to print.
Yeah, and Bob and Ray are examples of people. They're really funny, just as funny on the page as they are on the radio, which is remarkable. There's some comic writing that goes both ways and some that doesn't. It's an interesting thing, yeah. Steve Martin, for instance, I think is really funny, but I didn't think his book was funny at all. His book of called Cruel Shoes, whereas Woody Allen can do it both on the page and aloud.
But back to Mark Twain, you mentioned that Mark Twain, with his dialogue, wrote the way people spoke. But that's really tough these days to get away with something like that. It's even hard to read. I have a feeling that what writers do now is they say. So-and-so speaking with a lilting southern accent, and then they just write it straight without trying to use the strange spellings that Mark Twain did.
Well, but, you know, he wasn't all that heavy on the dialect. You can read, I used to read Joel Chandler Harris and Uncle Remus stories, Brer Rabbit stories, and a lot of people just can't read those today, but you can still read Mark Twain. The dialect's not that heavy, and he doesn't. You know, you can capture the way something sounds without misspelling everything. You can misspell something every now and then, but it's still possible to do. And people, I don't think people speak in general. People don't speak as in as good a sentences as they used to speak in. I mean, you listen to our last few presidents, for instance, and compare them to the way earlier, you know, every Civil War general used to just naturally write well in letters. Whereas today people, speech is sort of fragmentary and it's less, I think it's less literary. I mean, there used to be more of a connection between writing and speaking than there is now, because a lot of people don't ever write at all. They just talk on the phone. And talking on the telephone is no way to learn how to speak with eloquence.
Page 170, the essay that you wrote, What's So Humorous? What is so humorous?
Well, it's interesting to me that there is so much humorous writing being published these days. It seems to me there's an enormous resurgence. I remember back during the 60s when everybody was so serious about changing the world, there wasn't much funny stuff. I mean, there were things like MacBird, which was a satirical play about Lyndon Johnson having been involved, I mean, alleging that Lyndon Johnson was involved in the assassination of John Kennedy and things like that. I mean, they're really, really sort of heavy, savage, satirical works, but there you didn't have volumes of humor coming out, but you do now. And it seems to me that it's this is a sort of lighten-up age. You know, it's a lot like the 20s, I think, when there were a lot. You had, in the 20s, you had Dorothy Parker and Robert Benchley and Perelman and Thurber, and that was when Coolidge was just sort of letting things slide for a while under Calvin Coolidge, and I'm afraid that that's what's happening now again, that we're letting I was reading Martin Short was quoted the other day in a magazine article as saying that, you know, you can't make jokes about the deficit, and you know, there's all this, I'm afraid there's all this serious economic stuff building up that nobody pays attention to. People just want to hear jokes about something else, about Wheel of Fortune, whatever it is that Martin Short tells jokes about. I hope that we're not repeating the 20s, but it seems to me that they're in times of a certain kind of chipper but ill-advised composure in the White House. We do tend to have a lot of humor being published.
Well, you write humor, of course. There are a lot of humor writers today. You cited some names of people in the past, like Dorothy Parker and James Thurber and Robert Benchley. But I wonder, in terms of longevity, if humor, because of what appears to be its very topical nature, you have, for example, an essay in here about losing airline luggage,
mm-hmm.
and that might, in the future, be looked at as a problem that has been solved, and they look back at this quaint year of 1984, 85, when people were actually losing airline luggage, but mm-hmm. it's not lost anymore. So I just wonder if humor is the kind of thing that holds up for long periods of time, or if it just kind of puts itself in a niche and it stays there.
What's going to happen in the 21st century is that somebody's going to stumble upon all this luggage that's been lost in the 20th century, and they're going to be, don't know what to do with it. There's going to be about 400,000 bags.
Well, I think mine is one of those bags. Yeah, I hope I'm still around to get it back.
Right. Some humor, I mean, humor. Mark Twain wrote something about that. He was reviewing or looking at a collection of humor from 50 years before or something, and none of it was funny anymore. And it's true that things don't tend to stay funny forever. But Charles Dickens is still funny, and Mark Twain's still funny, and and Thurber and Benchley, I think, and Perelman is still funny. It's who knows what's still going to be funny. But and you do have to get away from making jokes about what's going on in Congress. I mean, that stuff doesn't tend to, people don't remember. That stuff for very long, but people are always going to be worried about their feet being too big and their mother-in-laws staying with them and things like that. I mean,
there are truisms in our lives that go on forever.
Yeah,
I have the road shows, you know, the road to Morocco and all the road to Zanzibar and all these Bing Crosby Bob Hope movies, which I enjoy. But if you look at them, you'll see they are extremely dated because. Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of references to things going on in jokes. It's almost like going into another century. If you were, of course, I remember it. I mean, it's in my era. But I would imagine a kid. I have a 17-year-old kid, and I imagine he doesn't like to watch them. He doesn't understand them. He doesn't think they're funny, and he doesn't understand them. I watch them and enjoy them, however, not because they reflect my growing up period, but because I think they are a slice of Americana.
Yeah, and you remember what they were like. Yeah. But there are movies on there. I think the Marx Brothers are funny, still just funny. And
absolutely. W.C. Fields, too. Charlie Chaplin.
W.C. Fields is still funny, yeah. And Buster Keaton. If you're good enough, you laugh. It's the same thing as serious fiction. I mean, same thing as a novel. Some novels seem great now, but they won't seem great in 100 years, and some will.
You know, Ring Lardner used to be described as a humorist, but he hated that. He hated to be described. He was always afraid somebody would come up to him and say, "Hey, you're not so funny."
Right. Well, I know what he means. Yeah. There's also something sort of deprecatory about calling somebody a humorist. I never wanted to be any kind of ist, actually. I used to be a Methodist, but that's the last kind of ist I want to be.
What happened after that? What did you convert to?
Oh, I just sort of... lapsed.
A lapsed Methodist. Yep. Well, let's talk about one or two other items away from the literary and the humor a little bit. One of the funniest articles or essays in your book was the one about what we can do personally to lick, so to speak, the federal deficit. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, it seemed to me that it's hard to imagine what to do exactly. You know, one thing, some people are saying that, hey, you know, it's not really money as we know it, you know, as you know it. It's just don't worry about it. And then other people are saying that if we don't eliminate the deficit in the next 3 months, the Arabs will own our grandchildren and everything. So it's hard to know how seriously to take it, but it seems to me that if it's that somebody ought to take it seriously and do something about it. It seems to me that if every individual American would buy, I've forgotten the figures I worked out, $20,000 worth of stamps and throw them away, then that would be $20,000 per American going into the government And not $20,000 worth, 20,000 stamps. I worked it out, so it was roughly affordable. And, you know, the government wouldn't have to perform any work for that money. And it would help out a lot. Now, other people have pointed out that that wouldn't work because the post office is a federal, is a separate company or something. So, but there's always, but there's bound to be some way to, because I'm afraid we're going to get caught out the last minute and have to do something really trashy to make up the money. You know,
now, wait, you're telling me that I should go out and buy 20,000 stamps, and yeah, this will actually help ease our deficit?
Well, it seems to me it stands to reason that it would. And the great thing about it is that it doesn't hurt the stamp industry at all. You know, if you, one sensible way to ease the deficit problem would be to, for every American to make a pact, an individual American to make a pact with an individual Russian, and they would both agree that they would ask their government not to spend the amount of money it took to defend them. Say Olga Petrova in Russia, I could get together with her in some way, and she would ask our government not to pay the amount of money it would take to defend her against me, and I would ask my government not to pay the amount of money it would take to defend me against her. But the trouble with that is it would hurt the defense industry and people would be out of work and stuff. But this stamp thing seems to me foolproof.
Yeah, but you have to destroy the stamps, right? Or not, just not use them.
Throw them away. You give them to children to play with. Just don't. If you put them on letters, then the government's got to do work. But, you know, if you just actually, and you've got some stamps. The reason I got this idea was that I had a roll of stamps and I left it in the window and it got rained on and it all stuck together and I hated the notion of losing $20 worth of stamps, so I figured, well, at least it helps the federal deficit.
Well, you have to soak them. You have to put them in a pan.
Well, people
told
me that, but the trouble, before I soaked them, I already tried to pick them all apart, and I just had all these little stamp shreds.
Can you imagine what 20,000 stamps probably make a nice patch of wallpaper in your bathroom?
Yeah, you could use them. They're pretty. There's some pretty little pictures on them. And,
they started making these real little tiny stamps, about half the size of the others. Have you noticed that?
Yeah,
I think they have birds on them or
gradually,
something.
Gradually they will shrink the stamp. So, but that seems to me a piecemeal step just to make the stamp smaller.
What's so hot about celebs?
Well, I think there's an awful lot of celebrity going around, and there are an awful lot of programs in which we go into celebrities' own homes, you know, and there we are. I don't know, Dick Van Patten's home or something, and nobody has much to say, but there we are, and it's interesting because, I mean, presumably it's interesting because he's famous, but on the other hand, it's not very interesting, and it seems to me that more and more of journalism is organized around trying to find out what famous people are like, and when it turns out that famous people don't have a whole lot to say, it doesn't make for great journalism, but there's a plethora of famous people anyway around. I think, you know, everybody... I sympathize with famous people like Michael Jackson who just want to do everything on stage and not be interviewed and not have somebody come over. I've done a lot of interviewing of people myself, and I can see why they don't want. I used to think, well, all you got to do is let me in your house for a couple of days and I'll talk to your maid and look through your laundry and stuff. I don't see why you would mind that. But now more and more I think. Not only do I understand why they mind, but I don't want to do it anyway. It's just there must be some kind of new thing of interest to take the place of celebrity.
Now, you're a celebrity. You just did this NBC TV broadcast, and you've been on Prairie Home Companion and written 5 books. You go out on 6th Avenue, 5th Avenue, Manhattan. You're mobbed by people that run up to get your autograph.
But I deserve it.
Yeah. You may have to walk around the street holding the book up.
I know, holding the book up and... No, I don't get a whole lot of recognition because everybody, well, I've taken the precaution of having every book jacket, every picture on my book jackets look different. And, I mean, everybody says that. Finally, people are telling me that this picture looks like me, and I'm beginning to worry.
You know? Well, the problem is that every picture on the dust jacket is another year or two older.
That's true. That's a problem that we're with even celebrities face.
How do you read the New York Times?
Well, first thing I do is, you know, it seems to me that New York Times is, a lot of people are sort of intimidated by the New York Times, but if you assume that it's there to serve you, then, for instance, so you come, one time I was in New York standing next to newsstand, and someone from an accent with an accent that was obviously from out of town went to the newsstand to buy the Sunday Times. This was a number of years ago, and he said, "How much is it?" And the news vendor said, 50 cents. And he said, 50 cents? That better be some newspaper. And I think it's kind of good to make demands on the New York Times. Say you come up here from Clanton, Alabama, or somewhere, and you know that you're the first person to be in New York in a long time from Clanton, Alabama, and there's no story about you in the Times, I think you have a reason to be upset. And there'd be a story about you in Clanton, certainly, if you went to New York.
That's the first thing you do in the morning when you pick up the Times, look for your name?
Yeah, look and see if you're in there, and if you're not, figure out why. There must be some conspiracy going on.
Well, you could look at the obituaries first,
yeah,
just to make sure.
That. Yeah, you could check that. Some people will go to any lengths to get recognized.
Well, to kind of wrap things up, maybe we could talk about, perhaps the one of the lighter essays in your book. This is about testimonial, head-on testimonial.
Yeah, I'd made a beer commercial once. It's probably why I'll never be admitted to the American Institute of Arts and Letters. I did a beer commercial, but I needed the money, and I had written a book about the Pittsburgh Steelers, and the Iron City Beer Company wanted me to do a TV commercial in Pittsburgh, and it's a Pittsburgh beer, and I liked Iron City Beer, so I agreed to do it, and it entailed something called the beauty pour, which means pouring a beer into a glass so that the head rises just to the rim lip of the glass and no further. I had to say a little something about Iron City Beer and then pour the beer in, and I had to do about 34 takes because sometimes it would not rise all the way to the top of the glass, and other times it would just run all the way down my arm as I was speaking. So I had to do it over and over and over. And I realized how hard a beer commercial was. One of the hardest things about it is that they won't let you drink any of the beer. I had to pour out 34 beers, and they would take it right away from me, and was in a hotel room, and they would actually flush it down the toilet. It was like getting ready to do a love scene with a beautiful woman, and just as you reach her lips, they snatch her away and bring on another one, and over and over and over. It was a really frustrating thing, but I figure I can do a beer commercial, and that's a real talent in our culture, because the best television is those Miller Lite commercials. The only part of television in which anybody acts like a real person is on one of those Miller Lite commercials where they act like they're really drinking beer. So the only problem is I have to disclose that I don't like light beer. There they are making all these authentic beer commercials about big heavy guys doing authentically beery things and being funny in authentically beery ways. And meanwhile, they got this fake beer they're drinking, they're promoting. So I just had to admit that I don't like light beer, and I don't particularly want to learn to like light beer, and therefore I've jeopardized my literary standing by admitting that I did a beer commercial, and I've blown my beer commercial future by admitting I don't like light beer.
You certainly have. And you know you had a great future in doing light beer commercials.
You never know.
Roy Blunt, another funny book from you. I'll certainly look forward to the next one next year, probably, presumably. Mm-hmm. One hopes. I was almost going to say hopefully, but I'm told that I shouldn't say that.
That's right. Thank you, John.
So one hopes that we will have you back in, and that New York treats you well, and the commute to Massachusetts isn't too hard on you.
Thank you, Don. Appreciate it.
Be talking to you.
Bye.